I call this meeting of the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee to order. It is February 20th, 2024. A quorum is present. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move the minutes for March 30th, 2023?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt moves the minutes for March 30th, 2023. Is there any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The minutes are approved. First up, we have several bills today, and as I mentioned earlier, Chair Cleburne will be coming later in the meeting. We have moved the agenda a bit around, so first up is Vice Chair Hewitt's bill, House File 3352. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move your bill?
I believe at this point the bill is being held over. We're moving it.
You still need to move your bill.
Oh, yes, sorry. I would.
Representative Hewitt moves House File 3352 be laid over for consideration at a later date. Representative Hewitt, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you for hearing the bill. It's great to be back in committee here. This is not a new bill to us. We've seen this bill before. We're just going to give it another try. However, there is an amendment. Can we take the amendment now?
Yes. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
I would.
Representative Hewitt moves the A1 amendment. Representative Hewitt, could you discuss your amendment?
The A1 amendment basically gives a pause to the bill to let the Amateur Sports Commission to research and find out exactly the impact that this is going to have on their space.
Is there any discussion to the amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hewitt to the House File 3352 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, members, thank you for hearing the bill today. I'll try to go as fast as possible. I have two testifiers, one from the Minnesota High School League. The other one is from the Amateur Sports Commission. Real quickly, this bill actually would allow the Amateur Sports Commission, after a referral from a commissioner of a youth league or the high school league or even an official in this capacity, to levy a $1,000 fine against a unruly sports fan. This is not another bill that's run in parallel that I have another hearing right after this one that actually charges a gross misdemeanor if an official in his or her line of duty is assaulted. This is basically one that will help us at this point deal with the problems that are uprising and that are continuing to elevate when all of us have been there in that situation where we have somebody we're sitting next to or somebody that is a little bit more vocal. And we're not talking about bad call ref or maybe question of my eyesight. As most of you know, I'm a referee. We're talking about that person that oversteps the bounds, that walks out on the floor, that grabs the ref or grabs a player or goes after a coach. And so that kind of behavior, and I'm disgusted that I even have to do a bill like this, but we're at the point where we have to legislate morality, and this is a bill. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to call the first testifier, Mr. Martin from the Minnesota High School League.
First up, Eric Martins, Executive Director of Minnesota State High School League. Director Martins, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Eric Martins, and I'm the Executive Director at the Minnesota State High School League. Pleased to be here, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Proceed.
I would like to bring greetings from our league and more than 600 member schools and appreciate the consideration here in finding ways to eliminate the highly disrespectful and unsafe behavior that a very small percentage of our fans display at youth sports events. We definitely appreciate Representative Hewitt's efforts to bring greater safety and respect to our officials, especially targeting those who engage in egregious and assaultive behavior. We also thank Representative Hewitt for stepping forward and assisting our schools by being an official with the Minnesota State High School League. Safe and respectful behavior has been a focus of the league for the last 2.5 years. We've done significant work. Just this fall, we hosted 9 regional meetings across the state with our students, culminating in a statewide conference at River Center with over 650 students and over 70 schools attending. Our focus is on making our events as respectful and safe for everyone that's involved. And what it comes to now is the primary piece of helping to make sure that all of our adult fans, and if it's student fans, amp up their behavior to the level that we need it to be to make sure that things are going to be safe. We need that strong example within our schools in order for them to be safe. Right? Any of the behaviors that Representative Hewitt described are the kind that put our games and our events in peril within our schools. And so we appreciate the work that's being done here. And just a quick estimation, just in the 5 sports of football, volleyball, soccer, hockey, and basketball, we have about 40,000 contests a year just in those 5 sports, and we have about 49 different activities that we have within the high school league. So this is important, and obviously there are youth sport levels far below the Minnesota State High School League that also have these needs. We currently do not have a tracking system, but we do get reports from our officials around these kinds of behaviors, and it is making a difference in a negative way when these things take place. It is becoming more and more difficult to retain the officials that we have, and certainly making it difficult to recruit officials. Our schools are stepping forward and actually offering officiating classes, and yet at the same time, we wonder what we're bringing our 15, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds into if we're not able to have those be safe. So we all know that these behaviors threaten the safety of our contests, and they threaten the current number of officials that we have currently, as well as the ability to grow. And we recognize the great appetite that our schools and our communities and our families have for youth sports. And so it's a priority to work on this. The league does not pretend to have all the answers as to how to work on this necessarily. We would leave it to Representative Hewitt and the committee to continue to work with us and others to determine the best path forward to keep our events as safe as they can. I really appreciate your time here this morning and your concern for the well-being of our students and our schools, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that anyone might have.
If we could get the next test fire, and then we'll do questions at the end, Mr. Chair, if that's possible.
Possible, yes.
Mr. Johnson.
Next up, Todd Johnson, Executive Director of Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. Welcome, Director Johnson, if you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Todd Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. We've had some discussions about this bill, and I really want to raise or thank Representative Hewitt for bringing it forward. Obviously, the devil's in the details and the implementation piece, and I appreciate the amendment. I just saw this morning that gives us some time to contemplate what this regulatory scheme would look like, and to the extent that the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission is responsible for putting this study together to report back to the legislature, we're happy to do that and to look at what that scheme would look like. Obviously, we come at it from the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission from a couple of different points of view. Number one, this is a little outside of our scope right now. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't be willing to look at it, but our primary objective in charge in our statute is to create economic tourism or sports tourism through economic development, and we do that, and we do it in spades, and the way that we do that, if you think about the events that we run, we are the largest amateur sports facility in the world. We run the third largest soccer tournament in the world, youth soccer tournament. Referees are a critical piece of that. Sometimes our events, we limit the number of games because we cannot hire enough referees, and it's directly attributable to some of these actions. People don't want to do it. We do all we can to train referees to be involved in that piece of it. If you think about the entity that I oversee, the National Sports Center Foundation, that runs the facility up in Blaine, it's about a $16 million affair, a business. We spent $1 million last year on referees between hockey, soccer, other sports. So it's a major component of the work that we do. In terms of the regulatory scheme to enforce this and to be a piece of it, it's outside of our scope right now, but we're more than willing to study it, to look at best practices, to sort out whether or not there is a scheme that we can come up with and come back to the legislature and report to you all on what we feel would be the best way to administer this provision.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, if we could take the questions on, then I'll summarize at the end.
First, is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Anyone else? Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As somebody who spent countless years of my life on the sideline up in Blaine watching our oldest son play soccer, went on to play collegiate soccer, I saw parents and spectators at their very worst. It is sad that you do have to legislate growing up. There is a place for people to question the judgment of a referee who is a human and will make a mistake. Most people, I'll just opine, most people do not know what offsides in soccer is, and I wish that they would study that a little bit so they might, you know, actually shut up. But I think it's a good reminder for us to recognize that referees are fallible and they will make a bad call, but adults who spill onto the court or the pitch or whatever have crossed the line. And I look forward to what the study might say. Thanks.
Is there any further discussion? Representative Hewitt, you know, in talking with you, you mentioned that it's hard to get referees, that it's an aging profession, and perhaps we need to look at the question of recruiting and retaining to get more folks into doing this. Any comments on that?
Yeah, and Minnesota, actually, and I found this out this morning, is looked at as a leader in training referees. I was telling the executive director in my office earlier that it's harder to maintain my certification for refereeing than it is my EMT license and my real estate license, actually. And so Minnesota is at the forefront of that, and referees take this very serious. Right now, if you want to do a state tournament, you have to watch a video every week and give feedback, and that's really important because, Mr. Chair, what this is about, and I try to really put this in a perspective, and I'm going to share a short story here with you. This year, I really had a trying year with this. I've been doing it 19 years, and this was the first year I really thought maybe I won't be back next year. And it's elevating. This sort of behavior is elevating for referees. I was at a local high school in St. Paul, I'll give you that much of it, and I knew it was a close call. I knew that the coaches probably are not going to agree with it, and like Representative Nash said, you know, there are those bad calls, not too many for me, the Representative Nash, but it could have been a bad call. But I knew the coach was going to come at me, and I expected that. What I didn't expect was the next person that came at me was the person that identified as the associate athletic director at the high school. Wanted to do a show on the middle of the floor with me, and that's my protector. That's the person that gets me out of the gym when all else fails. And my protector was gone. And that set the tone for the second half of the game. We have to stop this. This is ridiculous because what my job out there is, on the floor, out in the field, is about our kids. It's about them having the best experience they can have. It's not about me. It's not about the coaches. It's about our kids getting fulfilled when they go out there. And when you see this as an official, it's very, the synergy's there. It's very electronic. I can't explain what it's like. When you see a play that the kids work so hard to get and they have a successful score or successful try, it's unbelievable what happens on that floor and the spirit picks up. And even if the team's losing and you can step in as an official and say, you know, this score didn't go your way, guys or girls, but you know what? You played a heck of a game and I'm real proud to be out here working with you. And that makes a difference, and that's what every referee does in the state, but we're losing them. And this is part of the reason we are losing them is because they don't feel they're getting the support they need. And we need to train more. We have programs in high schools I just heard about this morning. We have programs at colleges. But I would encourage any of you around this table to become a real official. Talk to me if you're interested. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I thank you for listening to the bill today, and I hope we can get it on its way.
We did have one more question, Representative Freiberg.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Sorry for jumping in late. But I was looking at the definition of youth athletic activity on line 1.20, it's tied to another statute, so I looked that up. And it says youth athletic activity means any sport or other athletic activity related to competition, practice, or training exercises, which is intended for youth athletes. As the quiz bowl coach at Plymouth Middle School, I guess I feel like I have to rep the sort of more non-traditional activities. And I'm just wondering, I was actually moderating a quiz bowl tournament last weekend in Moundsview. And I was just wondering what, and everyone was well behaved. It wasn't, there were no problems or anything like this. But I'm just curious, and I don't know if this is a question for you, Representative Hewitt, or for your testifier or for House Research, but I'm just wondering if activities like quiz bowl would fall under this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, yes, that was the intention, and we're hoping to get this right so we include all youth activities. This bill actually goes all the way down to the youth level and then goes all the way up to the high school level, and it would include things such as quiz bowls, debate, dance competition. It's unbelievable, and everybody thinks that they're totally exempt from some kind of spirited fan, but they're not. And I have heard horror stories. And so we want to just send the message, and I hope that's what this does today, to let them know that we as legislators are working on something to keep our kids safe and to make sure their experiences when they do decide to take place in extracurricular activities is going to be right. And so I don't care what activity it is, but it should be covered in here to make sure they're going to be safe. And if we have one of those people that get out of hand, well, then they might end up with a $1,000 fine. And a safe means also, we have had situations where there was like fans that were bantering really badly of other teams. That could be considered too. And that's why we got to get this right. That's why the Amateur Sports Commission has to dive into this and make sure that we're doing it right and make sure how it's levied is fair and equitable.
Members, the bill is being laid over, so I'd encourage you, if you have additional questions, to work with the author on those. Representative Hewitt, are you renewing your motion that House File 3352 as amended be laid over?
Mr. Chair, I am.
The bill is laid over. Next up, House File 3431. And Chair Cleavorn will reassume the gavel.
Good morning, Representative Hewitt. How are you?
Madam Chair, I am doing well.
Would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 3431.
All right. It is our intention to lay this bill over. The bill is before us. If you would like to please describe your bill.
Madam Chair and members, this bill basically is a technical amendment. It adds members to the Board on Aging. To the Board of Advisory Board on Aging. Minor technical changes like updating the name of the Act cross-reference in the federal law, modifies and streamlines reporting requirements, provides more time for MMB to review admin's proposal on general service revolving fund rate, combines two similar reports, one produced each year and another produced every other year, into one streamlined report and produced every year. Madam Chair, I do have with me MMB. admin. Oh, I am right, admin. And I would like them to dig more deeper into the amendment if that's possible.
That would be great. And Ms. Farrell, if you would please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Julie Byrell, I'm the legislative director for the Department of Administration, and I also serve as a dance team judge, so I appreciate your bill before. thank you to the committee for hearing House File 3431 and to Representative Hewitt for authoring it for us. It is admin's technical policy bill. Admin provides a wide variety of services to state agencies and the public. House File 3431 makes technical changes to admin statutes and is our housekeeping cleanup bill. And I'll briefly summarize those proposed changes. So first, we're updating the Assistive Technology Act. Admin is home to STAR, which is a system of technology to achieve results, and they implement the Federal Assistive Technology Act in Minnesota. STAR helps Minnesotans with disabilities gain access to and acquire the assistive technology that they need to thrive. STAR loans out devices for Minnesotans to try out to see if they would like to purchase those. The proposed changes update Minnesota's statute to comply with the changes made at the federal level, and those include updating the federal public law references, changing the name to be the 21st Century Assistive Technology Act, adding a representative from the Board on Aging to STAR's advisory board. We're also changing the due date for the General Services Revolving Fund Rate Report. This is a report of the rates that admin charges for general services to other agencies. And this is things like leases and mail, workers' comp insurance, parking, et cetera. It's currently due on July 1st, and we are usually still working with MMB at that time to complete their review of those rates. And so we'd like to move the date to be September 15th so that we can be more on time with our report. We also propose to streamline the fleet reports. So currently we complete two very similar reports on the goals to reduce fossil fuel use in fleet vehicles. One is every year, one is every other year, and we are proposing to combine those two reports into a report that's included in the Office of Enterprise Sustainability's dashboard, which we update annually, and it's published at sustainability.mn.gov. And finally, we're clarifying a section of the Private Cemeteries Act. So admin is also home to the Office of the State Archaeologist, and they work in collaboration with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council to assess cemeteries. In 2023, the legislature approved an overhaul of the Private Cemeteries Act, but one line was inadvertently stricken as sections were rewritten. The removed line ensures that professionals working on probable and known American Indian cemeteries are approved by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. The language as rewritten last year was not clear that the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council retained that authority, so we want to explicitly put that back in. It also reflects the current practice of the Office of the State Archaeologist's work, and this change will clarify that that authority remains with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Those are the changes that we are proposing, and so I thank you for your consideration. Admin requests your support to complete this cleanup, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Barrow. Members, do you have any questions regarding the A1? Seeing no questions regarding the A1, all in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. Now we will go to discussion of the bill as amended. Yes. I understand that Ms. Chappelle would like to come forward and testify to the bill as amended. Ms. Chappelle, if you'd like to come forward at this time. We can ask the page to hand out those.
Yeah, they'll take those.
Let's take this. Thank you very much. Welcome, and if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Stephanie Chappell, C-H-A-P-P-E-L-L. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. In regards to the summary that you all just heard, there was one aspect missing, and that was a section 5, which was the A1 amendment. There is no House research to speak to the amendment, and it has not been provided to the public. Unfortunately, I was not aware of the time crunch with a Sunday submission and realized that, oh my gosh, this is being addressed. I need to get here and I need to submit this to you so it does not happen. The problem is that the A1 amendment is more than a technical change. It is the result of 2023 legislation, which mandated the DNR and the Minnesota Historical Society, a nonprofit, to review the entire statutes of the state of Minnesota and forward to you any barriers that need to be addressed in order for a transfer to take place. The report is inadequate. The report does not address federal priorities, such as the 1963 Federal Outdoor Recreation, 1963 Outdoor Recreation Act, and even a minute statute, state statute, 86A.055, which states an outdoor recreation unit, which the state park is, cannot be sold to reduce the general fund. The DNR has stated that the park has passed its lifetime. The park was created to preserve the history within the boundaries. The DNR, in its report to you, did not address the history and did not explain how that history has outlived its viable uses. The history dates back to 800 AD. From 800 AD to 1750, other indigenous tribes occupied the land. It was only in 1750 AD that the Dakota tribes began to inhabit that area. In 1862, as many of you are aware, there was a war. In the confines of Upper Sioux Agency State Park, 300 women, mostly women and children, were held captive for months against their will. They experienced horrific, horrific treatment, and those who survived that experience said it was worse than death. There are descendants of those 300 people that were never brought to the table to discuss the transfer of this park. Those people need to be included. I am here to speak on behalf of those 300, those, the descendants of those 300 individuals, and further on behalf of the nearly 600 to 800 estimated people who died. Most of them were just innocent bystanders. Please, I urge you to revoke the amendment as presented to you and has approved by you just moments ago. It does not consider the thousands of people who see that place has a connection to the generational trauma they experience. Generational trauma does not coincide with skin color or race. It is something that is with us. I am a descendant of players in 1862. I represent myself. I represent the numerous others who continue to struggle with it quietly because they had no voice in the matter. Please give them a voice. Please give this place the opportunity to become a center of healing for everyone affected by war and mass violence. It's our duty. We're Minnesota.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I do appreciate hearing your voice in the space. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Gehring, would you like to speak to the amendment?
Madam Chair and members, I can just describe briefly what the amendment does. So this amendment, A1, that you adopted repeals section 138.662, subdivision 33. That section is the section of law that designates specific sites within Minnesota as part of the Minnesota Historic Site Network. And that network is the set of sites that are administered by the Historical Society as sites that are historic to the state of Minnesota. This repealer would remove Upper Sioux Agency from that list of sites effective upon certification by the Commissioner of Natural Resources that site has been transferred to the Upper Sioux community. So it would no longer be state property.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Members, do you have any questions? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair Cleburne. So my question has to do with lines 4.7 to 4.10. What would happen in this case if the Indian Affairs Council refused to approve a professional archaeologist, what would happen if they refused? Would that end any work that was being done?
Thank you, Representative Doe. Commissioner, or Deputy Commissioner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, we collaborate with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and we have not experienced a time where we have they have rejected a professional. We just want to make it clear going forward that council has that authority.
Representative Doe.
Thank you. What would happen if they refused to concur? I mean, I think that's great that it hasn't happened, but obviously we're adding this in the statute for some reason. And if there's no reason to add it, then why are we adding it? What would happen?
Madam Chair, I believe you're correct that there would be a pause on that that project and until we could come to an agreement on how that area was assessed.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, I'm not aware of any other further discussion or anyone else wishing to testify. So I will renew my motion that House File 3431, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Next, we will move on to Representative Stevenson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Since you are not a member of this committee, I will make a motion that House File 3346 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is now before us. If you would please speak to us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a pretty simple and discreet bill. There is a very old provision in state law which says that the county jail must be located in the county seat. And I think my testifier might talk a little bit more about that bill, that old law and the nature of it. But what this bill does is it gives Anoka County the opportunity to build the jail if they choose outside of the city of Anoka. Anoka County's jail is in need of pretty dramatic renovations or replacement. It's in a state of disrepair and is not adequate either for the needs of the county or for the safety of the people who work there. There's a need to work on the jail. There have been discussions about doing it at the current location, which is in historic downtown Anoka, directly adjacent to the social district that many of you remember we helped create a couple years ago in the omnibus liquor bill. But the proposal would also dramatically expand the footprint of the jail, crossing a city street and closing that city street, more than doubling the bed capacity, and has caused a lot of concern from people who live in the city. The county and the city, I think, are engaged right now in a pretty cooperative and good discussion about this project and where it should be. Should it continue to be in downtown Anoka? Should it be somewhere else? This bill's just designed to give more flexibility to that discussion and allow for a wider range of possibilities to be considered. It's not inconsistent with what has happened in other places around the state. The difference here is Anoka is a fully developed city that's surrounded by other fully developed communities. So in other communities around the state, when they've addressed similar problems, they've built the jail in a township and annexed land, for example, into the community in order to get the jail out of a historic downtown. Anoka doesn't have that option. So this is just about providing some flexibility, doesn't require the county to do anything. And Madam Chair, I am joined today by a member of the Anoka City Council.
If you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Eric Skoquist. I'm a member of the Anoka City Council. Thank you for having me today. And I'll touch on a few things briefly that Representative Stephen mentioned. But like most counties in Minnesota, Anoka is the county seat and has hosted the jail for kind of since the beginning for over a century. Over that time, we've gone from being this standalone city that was surrounded by prairies, forest, to part of the metropolitan area. And now we're surrounded by other cities in the fourth largest county in the state of Minnesota. And now for over 2 years, the city of Anoka and the county of Anoka have been working to try to find a solution within the bounds of the current law to accommodate a new jail facility in the city of Anoka. Minnesota Statute 373.05 states, each county shall provide at the county seat and keep in good repair a suitable courthouse supplied with fireproof vaults, a suitable and sufficient jail, and other necessary buildings. So you can kind of see in the language, it's it was written in a little bit different time here. The current county and jail are in the same spot they've been in downtown Anoka for a very, very long time, when it was kind of your standalone courthouse and the grassy knoll in the middle, and now today it consumes multiple blocks, and it's in order to grow, it's going to consume multiple more blocks in our historic downtown. We as a city really ask you to consider and pass this to allow the city and the county flexibility to accommodate growth and expansion as the county grows and without having to engulf many blocks in our historic downtown, which we've been really working at creating a great, welcoming, wonderful environment with the help of Representative Stevenson and this committee. And so we ask that you continue to allow us to find a solution that both the city and the county of Anoka can work with. And all this does is really opens up some opportunities within other areas to consider if we have trouble finding a solution that works for everybody within the confines of our fully developed city.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We did have one member who had a concern about that. Representative Herr, do you want to add your comment yesterday about making sure that whatever the new location could possibly be, that it would be within a distance where families could? Was that not your concern? Okay. That was an issue that was raised, to make sure that the jail is within a proximity of the families that would need to visit their relatives. I understand we have another testifier on this bill. Tracy Strombeck, if you'd please come forward.
Hi.
Good morning, how are you?
Yeah, good, how are you?
If you'd please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Tracy Strombeck, and I'm a lifelong resident in Andover in Anoka County, and thank you so much for allowing me to testify today. I am here in opposition to House Floor 3346. This bill would authorize Anoka County to build their new jail anywhere in the county. The current law everywhere in Minnesota requires jails to be built in the county seat. The jail is currently attached to the courthouse in the county seat in the city of Anoka. There is no plan identified to build a new jail anywhere else in the county. The Anoka City Council is responding to a small group of residents in Anoka that want the jail out of the downtown area. Even the city officials have described this as NIMBY, not in my backyard. If Anoka County wanted to move the jail location and build elsewhere, the sheriff and county commissioners would be here to request it. This is the largest improvement project in Anoka County. If it were built outside the city of Anoka, it would require a new courthouse and a justice center. The estimated cost for a new justice center is approximately $500 million upwards to $1 billion. Anoka County does not have a plan or funding for that. Last week, I attended a joint meeting between the city of Anoka, the Anoka County Commissioners, and local representatives. Not a single county commissioner or the sheriff said they prefer another location. Everyone agrees there needs to be a new jail. This jail location issue is driving a political wedge between the city of Anoka and the county of Anoka. Imagine the precedent set by building outside the county seat. That would set precedent in all 87 counties in Minnesota. If you pass this for Anoka County, why not other counties? Should we move the Hennepin County Jail out to Corcoran or Dayton? Maybe Rogers. Unless the sheriff and county commissioners are before you suggesting new legislation, you should not pass this bill out of committee. Anoka County sheriffs, both past and present, want the jail next to the courthouse, and that is where it should be. Without the county here asking for this, there is no reason to change the law. Thank you, and have a nice day.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to members' questions. Any questions regarding the bill? Representative Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anybody here from the county to talk about this?
Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
I don't know that there's anyone here from the county to talk about it. I can tell you the county is neutral on the bill.
And I would just like to say we've already asked if there are additional testifiers, so we will move on to members' questions about the bill itself. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this question is more for Mr. Gehring. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, general laws versus special legislation and how it would relate in this instance? My understanding is that we should never pass special legislation for local gov where a general law is better suited. And I know that there are some exceptions for this. Can you just talk a little bit about that, please?
And Representative Nadeau, you know all questions go but to the chair.
That's all right. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. My apologies.
Mr. Gehring. Ms. Griffin, apologies.
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, so I'm assuming that you're referring to where there would be local approval, for example, and the effective date. There's a section 645.023 in the Minnesota statutes that talks about instances where a special law would not require local approval. And one of those circumstances is when the legislation is permissive. And here you can see in the language, it talks about Anoka County may, and so it could fall within that exception in the statute.
Representative Nadeau, is there a follow-up?
Yes, and thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies again. Commissioner Stevenson, thanks for bringing this. I know this is a big issue up there, and I know that's it's pretty controversial. And I'm wondering how we've gotten, I guess, to the point where there's an impasse between two local units of government that we quickly come to the legislature and try to create a space where you know the laws are pretty clear now, and an exception would be required. And I live and work in Hennepin. I can't imagine what it would be like to have the jail, in Corcoran or someplace else. I just can't fathom the logistics of how that would work efficiently. But I'm wondering why. I understand why you're bringing the bill. My question has more to do with why do we want to insert ourselves in between a local issue? That's my question.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nadeau. Well, first of all, it's good that you mentioned Hennepin County, because Hennepin County, as the chair is very well aware, maintains a workhouse in Plymouth.
It does.
And there's a lot of traffic between the workhouse facility in Plymouth and the courthouse in downtown Minneapolis, where, of course, as you might know, I work as a prosecutor. The other thing, your question was, why do we come so quickly to the legislature? The answer is it hasn't been quick at all. I actually introduced this same legislation a couple years ago because the dispute was already pending at that time. We didn't ask for a hearing at that time because there were discussions going on between the county and the city. Those discussions have kind of had their ups and downs. There have been times when it's been really bad and it looked like the city and the county were really going to come to, blows over it, I guess, in a metaphorical term. Right now, I actually think that conversations are going a lot better. I was at the joint meeting that the testifier mentioned, and I think there was a lot of talk about working cooperatively. Ultimately, this should be an issue that is decided by the county government in cooperation with the city. This bill doesn't change that because it is permissive, as you just heard. It just gives another option to resolve the issue. And so that's why we're bringing it today, just to give more options and then let the county and the city resolve what is fundamentally a question for local government.
And with that, members, I think we're going to move on because it is the Representative Nash, I'll get to you in just a second. It is a matter that we would like to see worked out, and which is why we're laying the bill over to give time for that to happen. Representative Nash, we're going to let you ask the final questions, and then we're going to close up this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did not remember that we were laying this over. I can save my ire for a later day.
Awesome. I always love it when you come at me. All right. If you would like to close your bill, Representative Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for considering this bill. As we just said, I think that there's a spirit of cooperation right now between the city and the county that I'm hopeful will continue. And, you know, we may come back and ask for more flexibility, but I'm hopeful that we'll be able to cooperate through this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 3346 be laid over for possible inclusion. Okay. With that, we're going to move on to Chair Lee with House File 3582. Welcome to the committee, Chair Lee. I will move that House File 3582 be recommended to be re-referred to Capital Investment. And with that, would you like to speak to your amendment first or discuss the bill first?
why don't I discuss the bill first, and then we can move on to the amendment.
Awesome. If you'll begin, please. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, members, for the opportunity to present House File 3582. This is a bill that I wanted to bring for, you know, after having traveled the state for the last three biennium as a member of the Capital Investment Committee. And so just a background for all of you, you know, over the years, I think the requests from local units of government and state agencies have increased. Just to provide some background, you know, when MMB came and presented before the Capital Investment Committee, in 2020, just a perspective for all of you, state requests was around $3.7 billion. Local projects was about 1.3. And then, you know, this year has got to 4.7 billion for state agencies and rough almost 3 billion for local units of government. And so I think that, you know, it's critical for us to have this conversation on how do we address our assets, whether that's at the state or local units of government going forward. And just wanted to, you know, I think just let you know the context for our state assets. You know, right now there's a deferred maintenance backlog of $6.4 billion. And so I think that as we hear and see on the tours, you know, a lot of the local communities that are coming before us, we are at the end of the useful life of when these infrastructure were put in. And so we have this discussion on how do we really help these local communities move forward, but at the same time plan for the long term and actually make sure that they could take care of their own assets too and not just come back 40 years from now for state assistance again for the same project. And so what I'm proposing in this bill is to require local units of government and nonprofits in the DE amendment to establish a replacement account to address some of the future needs that we may see. And this is not a new program or concept that I'm proposing here. We're currently doing this for the Water Infrastructure Funding Program. And, you know, I think this proposal is also in line with the best practices that's adopted by the Government Finance Officers Association to establish capital asset renewal and replacement reserve policies to help governments manage their investment and capital improvements and to give them tools to optimize their assets and for replacement. And so the DE2 amendments require any grantee receiving appropriation of state money for capital projects subject to Chapter 16 to establish the account for major rehabilitation, expansion, or replacement of capital projects. And after hearing some feedback from people who are interested in this, you know, we also had an exception or an allowance for other capital projects that the grantee may own so that this account could be used for other capital projects. And then we also have that a grantee must adopt a capital project replacement policy that specifies the following, the risk to be mitigated or managed by the fund, the intended use of the replacement fund, including but not limited to how the fund will be used for major rehabilitation, expansion, or replacement of the capital project, and criteria for the use of the fund to address other capital improvement needs of the grantee, including safety and security, maintenance and utility costs, availability of repair parts and materials, sustainability, and any other criteria the grantee deems relevant. Subdivision 2, the Commissioner of MMB must determine the annual minimal deposits amount into the fund by capital project type. The Commissioner must take into account depreciation, construction costs, inflation, and other relevant factors when determining the minimum deposit amounts. Subdivision 3, the State Auditor may audit capital project replacement accounts as part of the regular audits of local government. And then Subdivision 4 is the exemption for projects that already require a replacement fund, which is in the WIF statute. And then Subdivision 5 is a penalty for failure to comply is equal to 1% of the appropriations of the state money for the capital projects for each year of the noncompliance, and penalty fees will be deposited into the general fund. And so, Madam Chair, would that cover the DE2 amendment?
Thank you. Members, do you have, I just want to make sure I made a motion that we have the DE2 before us. So we do have a motion for the DE2. I move that amendment. Members, do you have any discussions regarding the DE2? Representative Nadeau.
On the DE2, Chair Lee, Madam Chair, my question has to do with line 1.21, 1.22. Why are we exempting the state from this requirement? It seems to be okay for local gov, but we're going to exempt the state. Why would we do that? Does the state already collect adequate money to replace all of its assets so we don't need to include them?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. The state comes to the Capital Investment Committee with their capital budget request for us to consider for funding.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. That's exactly what local units of government do. They have a CIP. They basically, they levy using ad valorem taxes or revenue resources. They literally budget those things as well. So, once again, is it because the legislature is I'm trying to think of how we're so much better as an adjudicator of capital and replacement funds versus a local unit of government. I'm still wondering why we're exempting the state from this important concept.
Representative Nadeau, am I hearing you wanting to put more money into the Asset Preservation Reserve Fund?
What's good for the goose is good for the gander, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Chair Lee, do you have any comments?
Thank you for that, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Representative. I think that this is an idea and a concept that I do want to explore with our state agencies, too.
Right. And Chair Lee, I just want to thank you for your willingness to work with me on this legislation and your willingness to continue conversations regarding this legislation. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Lee, you and I have talked about this as recent as yesterday on the floor. I guess my question is still, how is this going to impact small cities and their ability to put together, we'll just call it a CIP for lack of a better term. Everybody kind of understands that if you've been in municipal government. How are they going to handle creating a fund for the maintenance of, let's say, a water treatment plant or a water tower or whatever, when at the moment they may not even have the ability to put together enough money for the project, which is why they're coming to talk about bonding. I shared some local examples that both Representative Harder and I share and others share, and I'm just worried that this is going to make it so that those cities or counties or whatever couldn't even receive bonding if they're not able to put together the maintenance on their projects.
Representative Nash, before we go on with the answer to your question, you know, we still have testimonies. We're not into the full discussion of the bill. We need to adopt the DE2. May we move with that motion first?
Well, I think the question is germane to the adoption of the amendment, so prefer if we could get an answer to that.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash, for the questions. And, you know, after that discussion, I did reach out to the PFA, you know, who currently administer a similar program. And to date, you know, they are working with small communities for water infrastructure funds. And I asked them, are there any compliance issue? And there aren't. And so I think that, you know, just using that as a model, you know, we're going to hear some concerns. And I think that that's why I'm willing to work with everybody that's interested in this, so that when we, you know, go through the process of whether that's setting up the minimal amounts or whatnot, that we actually work with our state agencies to make sure that communities are not going to be impacted financially with this. And I think that some of the examples that we're even seeing from the memos that, you know, like from the League of Minnesota Cities or whatnot, is that communities right now have the ability to charge a fee for whatever type of infrastructure, and maybe that could be set aside for the reserve. And so, you know, this is an ongoing conversation. We're going to address this as it does move through the Capital Investment Committee process, too. And so for any members who are interested in this, I'm more than willing to work with this to make sure that communities will not be negatively impacted, but with the foresight that, you know, we do need to plan for the long term so that the state could address our responsibility, which are the state assets.
And having heard from the minority lead on this committee on the DE2, we are going to move to a vote for adoption of the DE2. All those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay.
No.
Hearing the motion prevails. The bill is now in the order that you would like. If we can move to testimony, if you're all right with that. I would like to call forward Mr. Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. If you'd please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. League of Minnesota Cities is the state association representing 838 of the 855 cities in the state. The 18 that aren't members or 17 that aren't members now are all under 200 in population, and we still answer the phone if they call. Very much appreciate the opportunity to make a few quick comments here, and am very grateful for the time that Chair Lee has spent in discussing this with us over the last week or so here. The DE2 amendment does reflect a number of the issues we discussed in earlier dialogue. I'm going to stick to the DE2, not talk about the history of what has changed, and only talk about what is in the DE2 in front of you right now. So to start off with, just a reminder, and the reference to it did come up, cities already do capital improvement planning. That's a major part of what cities do, is decide how much money in their levy they can set aside for purposes of capital projects they're going to need to do. When they come to the state is when it's determined that that's not going to be enough, or it's a project that is outside of the scope of what they are putting money away for. And so that's where we end up coming to the state with these increasingly expensive proposals of things that need to be done at the local level, asking for the state to be a partner in that. Usually the state is a partner in that, does not fund the whole project, only funds part of it. The changes in the DE2 amendment are very helpful in that they lead this away from, as much as I can tell, I do need to do a little more work on what the 16A reference encompasses for types of projects. But once we understand that, the intent, I know, has been to take funds that already have either repayment as part of the getting the money, so like the revolving loan accounts that we use for infrastructure, or grant funds that do have some sort of replacement requirement like the Water Infrastructure Grants Program, and not have that. This is not meant to, as I understand it, apply to those sorts of projects and those sorts of funding sources. On the first section, however, I do want to point out that there is no mechanism in here that limits what liability a community would have for repayment or putting money aside based on how much money they got from the state. So maybe you got funding for half of your project from the state. This does not say so then you would only be responsible for putting aside a certain lesser threshold. You would have to still put aside the full replacement cost of that project over the course of the funding for there to be an opportunity for you to get funding for half of it up front. I do think that that doesn't feel like it works quite right and would be a very major disadvantage for especially communities that are having a hard time getting the money in the first place. And I do think that there are still some more exceptions that we're going to need under Subdivision 4. There are emergency and disaster responses. There is some allowance to put that in your plan in this, but it doesn't make it very clear that that would have to be accepted by MMB as part of the plan. And time delays in getting access to those funds could also be a challenge. But very much appreciate the language that the author has put in to try and get some of that discussed up front in the plan, the way the bill is crafted right now. Overall, Madam Chair, we still have concerns with how this would work. The Water Infrastructure Grants Program that was referenced as a place where this works does not require full replacement funding to be put aside. It requires that utility rates be set at a sufficient level to maintain the facility and deal with expected upkeep and maintenance, but they still likely would need to come back for new funding when that project wears out. Over 20 years, the cost of a project easily doubles, and with at least with the projects I tend to work on environment issues, water and wastewater and stormwater and other issues like that, the technology and the environmental regulations increased dramatically over any 20-year window that we've looked at recently. So if we can continue to work on this, I hope we can get some of those issues addressed as we work in the capital investment program and further, and I'm happy to keep working with the author on those issues. Very much appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, and I think you just touched the heart of the issue. We want infrastructure that's been paid for to be maintained so that we have the opportunity to have the full life capacity of that infrastructure. Members, are there any questions? Representative Nadeau.
I have lots of questions.
Well, let's keep it to the bill itself.
And I'm going to keep it to the DE. I mean, the bill's
changed. The bill as amended.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's changed. This is going to make it more difficult for cities to move forward and partner with state government. It's going to impose additional and higher taxes, not knowing whether or not the city is going to make in 20 years a decision to replace that infrastructure or build new infrastructure. I'm glad that you changed the language. I'm glad that you amended the language. I think that's great. I think it really goes in the right direction. Because before, giving a commissioner the ability to almost set ad valorem taxes, it was really out there. So I really appreciate this. But as a legislature and as the chair of capital finance, you have the ability to evaluate those projects that people bring forward. I'd be the first one to say that we bring far too many projects forward for state funding. And, you know, maybe we should hone in and really try to prioritize.
Representative Nadeau, is there a question?
There is.
Okay.
We'd really, really try to hone in, what we want to fund. So my question specifically is, what value do you think this provides to either the state legislature or local units of government by enacting this legislation? What value is out there?
Firstly, I'd like to thank Mr. Johnson for his testimony and excuse him from the dais. Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair. And, you know, I think that's a really good question, I think, for us to decide as a legislature on what should be included in a capital budget bill or not. And, you know, like I mentioned to the stakeholders, I think that there's members on both sides of the aisles that don't think that we should fund any local projects at all. And, you know, for me, as the capital budget chair at this moment in time, I believe that, you know, commuters are coming to us and they do need help. And so why don't we step in and provide that help? But this is one avenue to help us ensure that we are planning for the future so that communities actually have a plan to fix the asset that we're putting money into so that we could continue to help out those other communities throughout the entire state that still needs help. And if you go back to my earlier remarks, we went from, you know, 1.4 last year now to 2.9, over 100% increase in requests, and we're going to continue to have that. And so without taking any kind of action, whether it's this or not, we're going to see those amounts come in, and, you know, we will have tougher decisions to make as a body. And so I think what I'm trying to get at with this proposal is that this is one option for us to consider as we plan for the future, that we help you right now. We really want you to have a plan to address your assets. And, you know, what we just heard from Mr. Johnson, I think that 20 years, they're going to come back for more funding. And so is that something that we as a body want to continue to do? You know, not maybe we probably won't be here, but I think that's for future legislature decides. And so I want us to start thinking about how do we plan for asset management going forward.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Further questions? Representative Bonner.
Less of a question and more of a comment. And I just want to say I realize that there's clearly some details to be worked through here. But I wanted to commend you for bringing this forward and thinking about this. I want to thank my grandmother for being a very conservative woman who liked to squirrel away money all over the place as a contingency. But one of the things that I hear very commonly in my community, and particularly from our more conservative members in my community, I live in a very purple district, is a question about why we don't do more to set aside money to maintain the assets we have, and why we're constantly being barraged by requests to raise local tax dollars to pay for projects that many of my citizens have said, why didn't we plan for that? And I do know that we do that on some level, but very likely not to the level we should. And so I really appreciate you exploring this idea of how we be good stewards of the money that we invest in our communities and how we maintain those assets. So I'm thankful to you, Chair Lee.
And with that, Chair Lee, is there any further comments you'd like to make?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to, you know, reaffirm that, you know, I'm willing to work with whoever is interested in this. I think to date, haven't really seen any, you know, actual language to make sure that we could address some of the concerns going forward. And so I'm more than willing to work with any members on here who's interested or outside groups who are interested in this issue.
Thank you. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3582, as amended, be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All of those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 3582, as amended, is re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. Chair Lee, we have your next bill before us, House File 3584, and I will make a motion that it be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. The bill is now before us. If you would like to speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Chair and members, for this opportunity to present House File 3584. As background members, you may know that, you know, Minnesota through MMB has three debt management guidelines for us. According to MMB, you know, having these three guidelines help us guide our decision-making, communicate policy goals, and demonstrate a commitment to long-term capital and financial planning. And so, you know, for me, when we're looking at this and I'm looking at the requests that we are getting from local units of government, we don't really have any debt management guidelines for our local communities. And so I think the goal of this bill is to clearly understand the debt capacity of local government as they come to us for assistance. And so this will just require, along with some of the additional information that we're already asking of them, to provide more information around their debt capacity when they provide that information for us when they go through the MMB submission process for their project. And so with that, that's the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lee. We have one testifier who signed up to testify. Mr. Johnson, if you'd please come forward. If you'll state your name for the record and please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson, again, with the League of Minnesota Cities. I can be very brief on this. We do not have a concern with the fact that it is being requested that this number be included in bonding applications. It's a public number. Cities normally include this in their annual financial reports to their communities, and the annual audit reports give a snapshot of where that sliding debt part of it is that can extrapolate out what the percentage is. What our concern is that cities only have one primary way other than for utility purposes of generating funds, and it's through property taxes. So anytime we have to generate more money, it's through property taxes. And it doesn't matter when that happens, that's our revenue stream. And so we want to make it clear that if cities are not at their full debt capacity, it is likely because they've determined they cannot sustain that on their property taxes in the community. It's the equivalent of going to the bank and you're told that you have good enough credit to get a $700,000 mortgage, but then being told that until you get up to that $700,000, we're not going to, you know, consider giving you any other support from the state for buying your house. And we don't do that. And we don't necessarily want people running at their full debt capacity. Debt capacity needs to be saved for emergency purposes, you know, not locked up for 20 years. So we do ask that this be considered as informational, but we are concerned about how that information ends up affecting bonding proposals by communities. We do not want to have a precedent that if you're not at your full debt capacity, you need to get there before the state looks at providing assistance. That's the only concern we have. We have, again, talked with the chair. He's been very gracious with time on this, and we hope to just make sure that as we move forward, we we keep that in mind, but we do not have a concern with including it in applications for bonding.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your testimony. Chair Lee.
Thank you, Chair, and you know I do appreciate the feedback from the league, and you know we'll work with them to address this if they have any solution. And I think what I would like to point is just that, you know, currently right now, through the MMB debt capacity report, if you all take a look at that, you know, guidelines. So there's three guidelines. Guidelines one and two said that, you know, this fiscal year we could bond for $3.3 billion, but that's not the case of what we're doing. You know, we're going to bond for $830 million if the legislature choose, because that's, you know, when you consider the three guidelines, that's the limit that we could. And so knowing that, you know, we have the capacity to bond for, I think that all of us and, you know, our local units government will make the decision not to max out, because we do want to make sure that, you know, we are responsible and that, you know, we continue on with our bond raisings as we have. And so I do hear that. But I think, you know, what we're seeing right now, even at the state level, is that even though we have the capacity to do so, I don't think that there's legislative interest to max out on our bond capabilities.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And Representative Hansen, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lee. You know, I think there was the discussion about the only source of revenue is the property tax. And I think something that might be valuable here with this debt capacity is also publicly available information should be submitted, which is the LGA amount that communities receive from the state. As I've been on these tours with you and we go around, I'm seeing an increased, shall we say, sense of entitlement that the state needs to pay for stuff. And so I think it's important when we're making decisions that we see what the state is paying for with LGA, in addition to the debt capacity that is there for the property taxes. I would just state, you know, there are communities that are coming for us that will never be able to maintain what they're asking for. And until we actually face that cold, hard fact, we're going to be wasting money that could be spent elsewhere where it could be covered.
Thank you. And members, is there any other discussion? Seeing none, Representative Lee, if you'd like to close your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, for the opportunity to discuss this.
All right, and with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3484 be re-referred to capital investment.
Madam Chair, it's 3584.
Oh, thank you for correcting me, 3584. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill, House File 3584, is re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. Thank you so much. Okay, and members, I believe that we have concluded our business for the day, and I'm going to ask that members please pay attention to the website for our next meeting. We will not be meeting this coming Thursday, so please pay attention to the website for our updated meetings. And with that, we are adjourned.